Hey everybody, Jan Rutherford with Self-Reliant Leadership. Hey, welcome to LinkedIn Live Office Hours. I am here with Dr. Megan Gearhart from Miami University and author of Gentilligence. Megan, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you and I were just chatting and I told you I'm so excited to talk about this topic because Gentilligence, the Revolutionary Approach to Leading an Intergenerational Workforce, is a book you just wrote. It was featured in Harvard Business Review. You talked about this in your TED Talk a few years ago. And, you know, what's been said a little bit is ageism is one of the last acceptable forms of discrimination we're seeing in the workplace.
That's right. Yeah, this is definitely my passion project. This is what I do all of my work in these days. So, you know, it really began for me when I began my career. I began as a 26-year-old faculty member, which was almost 20 years ago, and really started to, of course, get input and wisdom from my older colleagues, as most of us are used to doing. But because I was so close in age to my younger students, I found myself really asking for their input, their feedback, and love that. I learned so much in both directions, very different things, obviously. And so for me, it was really personal that I found it to be such an advantage in my career and learning from different kinds of perspectives. And really, because of the kind of work I do, I'm a professor of organizational behavior, of leadership and management. I thought, great, I can't wait to see how other organizations are harnessing this generational and age diversity that we all have around us. And long story short, they really weren't. So the work I've done since then has really been focused on one mission, and that's to change the conversation we're having about the power of age and generational diversity in the workplace.
That's awesome. And before I forget, for those of you dialing in, welcome. And we're on about a 12-second delay, so sometimes you'll ask questions, and it might be a little while before we get to it, but your questions are welcome. And in the meantime, if you could just post in the comments part where you're dialing in from, that would be great. I can see Tara from Annapolis and Brenda Batista and others. So welcome to this. And as we promised in our marketing, if you will, was this was going to be a little bit of a workshop. So we're going to try to really be practical and not just be didactic or academic. And, you know, to kind of kick things off, I wanted to put a graphic up. And Megan, these are roadblocks to Gentilligence that you've seen. And I wanted to touch on, you know, a few of these, and I'll take it down here in a second, but it's generational shaming and stereotyping, age biases, both young and old, myths about value differences and knowledge relevance. But let's kind of kick off by talking about generational shaming and stereotyping. What are all the stereotypes that we all, you know, that are inherent in some of our biases?
Sure. So just as a quick foundation, when we talk about Gentilligence, I want to make sure everybody is familiar with the term. So that's a term that I coined a few years ago. It really just means being smarter about how we interact with people across different ages and generations, and framing it really more as an opportunity than as a threat, which is hard for us to do because of those things that you're showing there on the slide. So we know that left to their own devices, an age diverse workplace or team will not probably be very successful. It will become frustrating. We'll have conflict, miscommunication, things a lot of us have already experienced in our day-to-day work, but that we can turn that around with some of the practical tips and tools that you and I are going to talk about today. So let's talk about, as you said, the roadblocks that tend to get in our way. Why doesn't this naturally happen? So generational shaming and scapegoating would be all those sort of clickbait headlines we're all used to. So a lot of audiences I talk to across different companies will say, you know, I don't know how I feel about generational differences, or I don't like to be stereotyped based on my generation, which I absolutely get, because Gentilligence is not about stereotypes. You know, you're not going to describe someone accurately just simply based on a year that they were born. The stereotypes and the scapegoating is really saying, you know, because you were born in this particular period of time, you're like this, which is very lazy. Generational stereotypes are lazy. And of course, if we start with, you know, okay, boomer, that boomers are out of touch, that boomers aren't astute at technology. There's no research backing up that baby boomers aren't proficient at technology. There's some interesting differences in their interest in learning new technologies or the learning curve for those of us who didn't grow up, you know, with an iPhone in our hand. There's some differences there. But in terms of being able to master things like technology or being open to change, there's not much data to support those stereotypes. If we quickly go through some of our other generations likely on the call, and these are, of course, US-based generational categories. So I know we could have a global audience, and obviously globally, yeah, there's different generational categories. So that's important to acknowledge. But Gen Xers, that would be my generation. Gen Xers are often stereotyped as being the slacker generation. And there's great sort of narrative in a sociological reason why we develop reputations is the way I like to think about it. And really what they're talking about is how do the norms or differences of a generation compare to the ones before and after it? At the group level, what are some interesting trends we might see? And that's often gets shortened into these kind of lazy stereotypes. So Gen X as cynical, as slackers, because they didn't embrace the same maybe work ethic or dedication to career as a cohort, as was seen in the baby boomer generation in terms of intensity. If we go to our millennials, the most talked about generation in history that we've had here in the US, of course, they are stereotyped often as entitled. I've pushed back a lot on this one on their behalf. It's a generation that's very proactive. It's a generation that was raised to have a voice and be developed at a much younger age, have opportunities at a younger age than older generations were able to have. So they have been stereotyped as entitled, but really, if looking from a different perspective, more proactive. And then, of course, our youngest generation in the workforce right now would be our Gen Zs. Our oldest Gen Zs will be turning 26 this year, I believe, if I did the math right on that, maybe 25 this year. The verdict's still out, right? These are people that are anywhere from like 10 to 25 years old. So that's a pretty wide sweep at this point. Only half of them are even of working age. But of course, you know, Gen Z has been called snowflakes, things like that. You know, the reality is none of those stereotypes are really accurate. They're tapping into shortcuts or lazy generalizations we make when we don't really understand the complex identity that goes along with being born in a particular period of time.
Yeah. And we've got, I asked everybody what generation they're in. We're getting some X, some boomer. And it's funny, Megan, you are on the, you're sort of X millennial, and I'm a young boomer. And so I'm a little boomer X. And, you know, it's kind of funny because we can all relate to some of the stereotypes of our generation, but there's a lot of them that we're like, no, that's not me. I mean, I've always been tech savvy. And then we've got Danielle, a millennial. So, you know, this relates to something you wrote about, which is an interesting phrase, homophily. That's really what this is all related to, is we're making all kinds of assumptions, aren't we?
We are. And, you know, homophily is this idea that we tend to gravitate to what we know. We tend to gravitate to people that we perceive as being, quote, like us. That's a human tendency. And when we look at the workplace, we have, you know, we also call it age polarization. So we tend to gravitate to people who are in similar age groups to us, often because they're in the same cohort as we are in terms of their career stage. So it's hard to unwrap, you know, career stage, age, and generation are all sort of intertwined a lot of the time. But, you know, if you think of the people you work with on a regular basis, most of the time they're relatively close in age to you. And what this means from the perspective of how it gets in the way of our gentelligence is I probably don't have an opportunity to interact with people who are a lot older or a lot younger on a regular basis. And because of that, I don't know them well. I have to rely on shortcuts, which is what bias is, right? So age bias is the next shortcut, or I have to rely on stereotypes, generalizations to fill in the blanks, because I don't have very many personal connections, unless it's a family member, right, of people at work that I know well. And so that's where sort of this lazy stereotyping comes from. And when people say, well, we should just get rid of generations, you know, I don't like these categorizations, what they're saying is we need to get rid of stereotyping. And I agree with that. What I say is, you know, generations are best looked at as a layer of your identity. So, you know, of course, there is value to thinking about how did growing up in the particular era of time that you did, in the culture that you did, in the place that you did, how did that influence your worldview, your view of your career, the opportunities available to you in a similar way than maybe than it did, you know, with people similar age to you, right? Just like the music you listen to. But like, if you think about, you know, a great example is I did a workshop with some silent generation individuals. So these are people born 1928 to 1945. So most not in the workplace anymore. But we had such a great conversation. I said, what are some of the formative experiences you believe for your entire generation, whether it was you personally or not, really changed the game? And one of them they talked about a lot was the GI Bill. The fact that for a lot of these people, they were all men, that they had the opportunity to go to college and they were the first people in their family to go to college because of the GI Bill. And had they been born during a different era, that wouldn't have probably been possible for them. And it completely changed the course of their life. So that's just an example. Right now we have the pandemic, right? What does growing up, right, as our Gen Zs are, our formative years being right in the midst of a pandemic, that's going to fundamentally change the way they look at the world, their place in it, their risk propensity, opportunities available to them, the same way, you know, it will affect other people in that cohort. So that's generational identity is much smarter and more interesting way to think about it, because it's a layer of who you are. It's not all of who you are. Stereotypes say this is everything we are, just based on this one thing about us, which of course is not a smart way to think about it.
Yeah. And Tara just made this comment: hardwired behavioral drivers and personal experiences have a significant impact on how we show up regardless of our generation, which I'm sure you agree with. Here's a question, Megan. And Tara, I appreciate the comment. And again, comments, questions, welcome. Here's something, and this is probably a little bit controversial for me to say, because inherent it will be some biases and assumptions. But, you know, we've got a lot of people that are really, really, really evaluating work these days and what they want and what, you know, Aristotle said, you know, what's a good life? And are you living one? And what's that mean? What's success look like? And people are redefining that. And there, I have a lot of clients that say, you know, when it comes to succession planning, I feel really good about the next 5 to 10 years. I know who's going to be in the seats and all that. And a lot of them will say, I'm worried about 10 years after that, because, you know, there's people that are, you know, that they know want to move up and want to work really hard and put all this stuff into a career and are going to take on more responsibility. And they're worried that there's a lot of people that, you know, want to work from home and have an independent career, that there aren't going to be, you know, these leaders. There isn't going to be that same commitment to work and that work ethic, and that some demographers and prognosticators and forecasters are saying, you know, we could be in a Great Depression in 10 years because, you know, a bunch of older workers will be out of the workforce. There'll be a lot fewer people. They're not going to have the same propensity for work today. Again, big philosophical question. And again, inherent in that is all kinds of biases and assumptions and different things. But what's your take on, you know, 10 years hence?
Oh, well, I got all kinds of takes, as you might imagine. You know, I think really important to remember is, you know, the first practice of Gentelligence that we talked about in the HBR article as well is identifying assumptions, right? So when people are sort of pulling out their hair or, you know, woe is me, you know, we aren't going to have future leaders that have the same work ethic. You know, I think part of, I want to drill into what do you mean by work ethic? You know, when you think about any sort of era that we talk about in terms of work, you know, one of my favorite quotes, and I'm paraphrasing, says, you know, every generation develops the tools they need to be successful. So I agree with Tara's comment about behavioral drivers and personal experiences. And the other layer we want to put on top of that is every generation has norms that they develop, that they learn in part because those are the things that they internalize about how you become successful and also how success is defined. So a great example of that was our baby boomers as a generation, you know, were sort of put, all this optimism was placed upon them. They were going to rebuild and create this new possibility for America after World War II. And they kind of seized these opportunities work-wise that their parents and grandparents didn't have. And they wanted to make more for themselves and more opportunities for their families. And because of that, you know, the term workaholic was coined, right? The 60 to 70 to 80, sometimes hour work week, the dedication to one organization that their parents and grandparents had instilled in them. So we see some things that are commonalities and some things change. You know, that became defined as work ethic. And then for my generation, Gen Xers as a whole, you grow up watching that and thinking, all right, do I agree or disagree? Did that work for my parents? Did it not? Did it work for society? Do I like it? Do I agree with it? And you start to see some sort of group level trends where, you know, the slacker moniker for Gen X came because here you have a generation, it was probably our last generation where children were sort of around, allowed to be free range in the US to be independent. We had mom and now possible, or dad and possibly mom, right? Because of women's rights, this Gen Xers were really the first generation where both mom and dad arguably were probably working outside the home, or more single parent families. So Gen Xers sort of had a lot of independent time to think about whether or not that was a setup that was going to work for them. And when many of us came of age and began our career, there was sort of an interest in redefining what does success mean? Does success mean the highest point on the corporate ladder? Does it mean upward mobility at any cost? Does it mean workaholic? And for a lot, not every Gen Xer, I don't consider myself a slacker, but I certainly do internalize the idea of defining success on my own terms. And the slacker came from boomers saying, well, what do you mean you don't want to work 70 hours a week, or you don't want to, you know, you want work-life balance? That's not an option, but it was, right? And so I think when we talk about what will the future be, our future leaders are going to help us redefine what work is. That's what we're doing right now. We have this amazing opportunity. It's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity to really redefine what will it mean to have a strong work ethic? Does it have to mean, you know, the sort of sacrifice it did before? Can we figure out how to make work integrate better with life? Can, you know, can we think about values aligned organizations and, you know, arrangements that work for all of our commitments? And I'm not so worried about it. You know, I think we adjust over time. Where we get in the ditch is where we look at something that's different that another generation is navigating on the terms that they figured out. And we look at those norms and say, well, those are wrong because they're not the ones we used. And it's like, well, right, they're not beginning their careers in the time we began our careers. So we better be careful to not judge the norms that they have developed in order to become respectful, you know, competent and successful.
Yeah, the, you know, it's really interesting. I think, you know, for me, what I see the greatest leadership challenge going forward is leaders are going to have to personalize leadership, just like healthcare providers are going to personalize healthcare, trainers are going to personalize workouts, that we're going to have to look at everybody, their different drivers, their different stages in life, how much they want to work, what they want to do with the company, where the boundaries are, and at the same time, be perceived as being fair. So you might have a 65-year-old that works 5 hours a week and a 25-year-old that works 5 hours a week. Then you might have a few 40-year-olds that are, you know, want to get promoted and want to take on more responsibility. And you've got all these people working differently. And I think the days of basically saying everybody's going to come in, work 40 to 50 hours a week. The culture is us all being together all the time, even though you walk into any place today where it's all back to work. Everybody's sitting in cubes with headphones on. Leaders still haven't figured out how to bring people together and collaborate. I mean, you know, that's the thing I think that's the big challenge. And to me, what's exciting about Gentiligence is, oh, how cool this is. I mean, we talk about diverse teams and the strength of them. You know, and a lot of times we think about it just from a gender perspective, but you're really asking us to look at it from an age perspective and beyond that, right?
Right. I mean, I think I embrace all kinds of diversity, but that's one of the things that's continued to drive my my work in this area is that, you know, if we think about the inherent power in well-managed diversity, again, not just, hey, let's get all these different people together and see what happens, but well-managed and well-led diversity, I'm not saying we've come close to figuring out the secret sauce on and other kinds of difference, but age and generation, which are connected but somewhat different, really the missing link. You know, very few organizations include age in their DE&I strategies. And the question is why, considering that it's a kind of demographic difference that every single organization has and has had for a long time. It's kind of reached fever pitch. It reached for fever pitch when our millennials entered the workforce and were so very different to the point where we really didn't know what to do about it. But also now, because as you said, demographically speaking, we have, you'll hear people say in the US, five different generations in the workforce. We're getting close to it being four. Mm-hmm. But now with the, you know, COVID, post-COVID, however we want to define it, and the Great Resignation, we're seeing all these really interesting trends around baby boomers aren't really necessarily interested in retiring. We've been sort of holding our breath for when that was all going to happen, this mass exodus. Of course, many still interested in working for much longer. I think all baby boomers in the US will reach 65 by 2030, but many will continue to want to work for a decade plus after that. The question is, where are they going to work, right? That's a question we raise in the book. You know, many of them very loyal to an organization their whole career. And now with the kind of pause and deep breath from the pandemic, many are thinking about, well, do I want to spend my next decade or however long I decide I want to keep working for with the same company? Do I feel valued here? Would I have more opportunities for development somewhere else? So again, that's a really important assumption that, you know, our older workers will keep, you know, will stay where they're at till they retire. Many are starting the second or third act career. And I think that that's really, really important. So,
well, it's interesting, Megan. I work with probably close to 20 companies pretty regularly, high level leaders. I work with only one person over 60. Mm. One. And, you know, he and I often talk about, well, where'd they all go? Are they all working at Home Depot? You know, where are they? It's interesting. And I've had a lot of friends that if they lose their job for whatever reason after the age of 50, oh, forget it. It's going to be really tough because, you know, the assumptions are, you know, you got plenty of money, your energy level's low, you don't get technology, and you know, they don't even get interviewed.
Yeah, I'm hearing that a lot. I just recently launched, this is not a sales plug, but I recently launched Gentelligence Academy, which is a remote training platform to become certified in Gentelligence. And part of the reason I did that is I had worked with a lot of older individuals who said, how do I signal to an employer, a prospective employer, that I get this, I care about it. Of course, I have a ton to teach, but I also am somebody who loves to learn, and I don't care what age person I learn it from. I want to continue to develop, and I want a way to signal that. And so the Gentelligence Academy gives certification in that as just one way, right? I was thinking, how do we help people communicate to employers that, you know, they shouldn't be assuming that because they're older in age that they are done learning, not interested in change or adaptation. Again, there's no data supporting any of those things, but, you know, really prevalent that I'm hearing a lot of stories similar to the one that you said. I don't know if you want to, if we go back to those roadblocks, you know, we've kind of talked about, that's an age bias, right? That's the second one, that we have age bias. People over 40 in theory are protected by federal laws to not be discriminated against because of their age. But how do you prove that? Right. And, you know, that's a pretty tough one. And then on the other side of it, just so we're careful to understand that Gentelligence is about championing all generations. There's no federal laws protecting younger people from age bias. So you can have the same amount of experience or skills or qualifications as someone older and not get the job because of your age. And that's not illegal. So it's a problem in both directions, age bias. And that's the second roadblock that we talk about that's really creating an issue, right? And it's creating an issue where we're really looking at each other as competitors rather than collaborators. And that's where we're falling down, right? You have to be able to look at somebody older or younger and say, I bet we could accomplish more together than we could separately. And how interesting that I get to learn and work with this person who probably has a different skill set or kind of expertise than I do.
Well, I do find myself coaching people that, you know, related to a military unit where they have the saying selection is an ongoing process. And to use a sports metaphor is you have to make the roster every year. Is I do find myself in coaching older workers that, hey, you know, you've got to stay up with it. You've got to be faster, stronger, smarter, to stay on the roster. So I'm putting a couple comments up that we've had come in, which are, you know, some really good things. One there from Patrick, another one from Paul, and a few people are kind of commiserating a little bit that they can relate to being over 50 and how that dynamic changes. So I want to shift a little bit in the time we have remaining and talk about this great article you just wrote, which is partly taken from your book. And you write, to make the most of our multi-generational workforce moving forward, the four key practices of Gentiligence should be applied when crafting talent strategies. And you're talking about, and we've talked about this a lot already, resisting assumptions, adjusting the lens, strengthening trust, and expanding the pie. And the one I want to go to first, because it seems like that comes up all the time, is the trust piece. What's your thoughts there on that? Because you get into a little bit of quoting Amy Edmondson and psychological safety. What's your thoughts there? Because again, a lot of this, I mean, that has to be the foundation for us all working together.
It does. And it goes back to my comment about collaborating, not competing, which is very hard if you've been passed over for opportunities on either direction from someone that you perceive as being preferenced because of something like age. So it, you know, it does root in psychological safety. So the idea that you're not going to want to learn or collaborate or share, you know, knowledge or information or expertise with someone if you feel threatened by them. And threat comes from this lack of security. It comes from the fact that I don't know whether my contribution is going to be respected, valued, heard. And then the other piece of psychological safety is I don't know if I feel safe to be vulnerable here. So one example that I like to share on this is, so of course we all remember the overnight switch to Zoom and how we all were expected to like immediately bounce and rally. And so in my world, that meant we all needed to get our classes online. We sent all the students home. We had, I think, 2 days or something to get classes on Zoom, and none of us had used Zoom before. And I had taught online before, but not in that kind of a format. And so I, you know, immediately my mentality was I went right to my students. You know, my psychological safety with my students is very high. I work a lot with my students every day. I've learned Venmo and Instagram and Canva and you name it. I've learned it. I stick my head out the door 3 times a week and say, can someone please come in here and show me how to do this? Mm-hmm. So I did my best, you know, I put the class together and then reached out and said, hey, we're all in this together. I'm going to need your help. If, you know, there's certain things I don't know how to do. So I would love it if we can kind of crowdsource this and figure it out together. And I had a colleague who's about 15 years older than me who didn't do any online teaching. His class wasn't online in terms of a platform learning system or anything at that point, called me just terrified and said, you know, is there any way you could help me learn to do this? And that was a big thing for him because, you know, I am younger than him, but I've been working with him a very long time. I said, of course, I'm happy to help you walk through it, but also remember your students are there and them know that they would be happy to help. And that thought to him was not acceptable, right? He had very low psychological safety that he said, I would never ask them to help me. And again, that goes back to that sort of greatest leadership fallacy that you're expected to know everything, right? That you shouldn't ask for help, you know, Brené Brown's work on vulnerability. And yeah. You know, I think it goes both directions. If we take it back to generations, as a 45-year-old, I should be able to ask at any point people younger or older than me, does anyone know how to do this? Like, I'm not great at this. Can somebody jump in? If I'm 25, it's probably expected that I'm going to ask for help. But what if I'm 55 or 65? Do I feel less psychologically safe? Because I don't want to be seen as a dinosaur who doesn't know how to use Zoom. Like, what judgment is going to be cast on me because I had to ask? But then on the flip, you also have to feel appreciated and valued in terms of your ideas or input. So maybe a 55 or 65-year-old feels like, of course I get to have input. I've earned it, right? I've been here a long time. My ideas are valued. But if you're 25, do you feel that way? And particularly our younger generations were raised that their ideas and their voice was very important and had value. We raised them that way. That was sort of our sort of focus with both millennials and Gen Z. So we shouldn't be that surprised when they go to organizations and if they feel their voices aren't being valued or heard because they are too young or they just got there, they don't feel psychologically safe and they leave, right? Yeah. And so it's relevant. It doesn't matter what generation you are. It's all about the fact that I have to trust a couple things back to trust. You need to get everybody focused on your shared mission, organizationally, team-wise. What are we all here to do? And once I feel comfortable and I trust that my, for example, younger colleagues understand what we're here for, then I can feel a little bit more safe to say, I would love to hear how you would approach this. Yeah. I say that all the time. How would you do it? And that's, you know, we want to make this tactical. We want to make it practical. That question is a $1 million question, because what happens when I say to somebody older or younger, I would love to hear how you would approach this, or I would love to hear your ideas, or how would you get us there? Something magical occurs, right? Because I'm showing that I value their input and their perspective enough that I'd like to hear it. So they begin to feel respected. They feel valued as a member of the team. I'm learning something, regardless of whether or not I agree with their idea or it's how I would do it. I'm definitely learning. And then let's say it's a younger colleague of mine. They give me maybe this very fresh new idea, something I've never thought about. And maybe I have concerns, right? I'm not saying we take all these and accept them, but I've asked for the input. And now if I want to give feedback, right, that's maybe how my teaching is going to occur. They're much more likely to listen to it because they feel respected. She respects me, so I'm going to mutually respect her. And I can then say, well, I love that. Here's a couple questions I have. Like, how would we get funding for that? Or there might be a reason why we couldn't do it that way. How would we explore that? Right. And so you're starting to build trust that we're not in some sort of imaginary tug of war. We're all here to help us get to this shared goal. And isn't it amazing that research supports that generations have access to different informational networks, different kinds of inherent natural expertise? And that's how you tap into that and increase the likelihood that you're going to actually leverage generational and age diversity for greater success, greater engagement, and today, really important, greater retention of your talent. So whether you're 25 or 65, you feel heard and appreciated and valued, you're going to be a lot more likely to stay.
Yeah. I've heard DEI summarized, diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging. I've heard it summarized as, you know, two questions. Do I matter? Do I belong? And I think, you know, as a leader, being very intentional about making people feel they matter, their job matters, and that they belong. And one of the things, going back to psychological safety, that I see a lot of leaders, high level leaders, not do is want to show any vulnerability and ask for help. And I often explain a metaphor of what happens out on expeditions I lead. Someone will lean over and say, you know, let me help you up this rock. And they'll go, no, I got it. And they struggle up. And I'll pull them aside and go, do you know what you just did? Yeah, I made it up myself. Like, no, you just denied somebody the honor of helping you, because you're a big deal. You're a chief operating officer at a Fortune 500 company. And this person wanted to help you, and you denied them. And they're like, oh, I do that at work. And part of what we see with executive teams, if nobody on the executive team will say, I need help, that team will not coalesce and come together. And if that's not happening at the executive level, of course, there's not going to be psychological safety below, because everybody's going to feel just like that leader. What's role modeled is, I am not vulnerable. I am not weak. I don't have to ask for help or say I don't know or anything like that. So this goes back to leaders being really intentional about the environment they create, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that's, I think, gets lost in these conversations a lot is, you know, when we were writing the article for Harvard Business Review, one of the editors said, you know, how's this stuff better than just good leadership practice? And I said, it isn't. But the point we're making is that we don't apply these things when we don't think about the role that, that generational identity can have and how people interpret these. So, you know, universally, every generation, every age has similar intrinsic needs. We have a lot of research to back that up. So, for example, everyone has the need to be respected. Everybody has the need for agency or autonomy in their work. So if we just look there, right, then we would say, well, generational differences are, you know, doesn't matter. It's all much ado about nothing. But we miss a really important part of the conversation, which is while our needs are the same, the norms we've learned on how to fulfill or pursue those needs are different because of when we grew up and what was taught to us. So I tell the story a lot of my dad, who's 73. He's a retired baby boomer. He was an attorney. And he said when he grew up, or when he started his career, you know, he, to get respect, he, you know, you put your head down and you were quiet and you waited your turn, right? You waited for somebody to tap you on the shoulder and say, you've earned it. Like, it's time for your promotion. And he said when he retired, his young employees, so they would have been millennials at the time, were coming in to tell him that they felt ready for, they were ready for their promotion. And that to him seemed very wrong, right? It was wrong because it was different. And when he shared that story with me, I thought, what a great Gentelligence opportunity, because both he and his younger employees had that intrinsic need of wanting respect. But yeah, his millennial employees were raised that if you want respect, you go ask for it. You go tell them you're ready. You raise your hand. You go in, like, it's time to go. You go get it, and you have voice. And if you understand that the driving need is the same, but the behavior might look different because the norms of the time were different, you suddenly say, oh, we have really interesting commonalities, but also interesting differences. And if I'm judging the behavior, not the intent, we're going to get in the weeds. And so, you know, a lot of Gentelligence is about saying, you know, what assumptions are you making? You know, how are you violating trust because you're judging something as wrong because it's not how you would have done it? And instead, can you take a step back? And as we talked about sharing, you know, creating trust, looking at that big picture and saying, well, we're all here for the same thing. And how can I provide people respect, connection, autonomy in a way that we all need, even though it might look a little bit different depending on the generation or age of my employees.
Megan, can I challenge you on something?
Sure, of course.
So I'm getting a little bit ahead. Hopefully, let me just double check something. Yeah. Are you hearing echo? Or not? Okay, that's just on this side. So what I wanted to challenge you on, you said, you know, we can't judge a behavior. We've got to understand the intent. In the business world, in the coaching world, we coach people to only coach on observable behavior because we're not mind readers. We don't know what people's intent are. That would be an assumption. Mm-hmm. So what's your thoughts there?
I think definitely we want to be careful on assumptions, right? Assumption audit is one of our tools we talk about in the book. So, you know, I think when you find something that doesn't hit you right, right? And it can be anything. I've probably done 300 workshops, and it could be, I don't like it when they take out their laptops in a meeting, or my coworker doesn't respond to a text, or my opinions are discounted, or, you know, whatever it is. I always say pause and then adjust your lens. That's another one of our practices, right? If something, you're judging something is wrong because it's different, you need to dig deeper. And so, you know, instead of making an assumption, you need to ask. So not rocket science, but a question almost never applied to this kind of difference is, help me understand.
Yeah.
Right. So help me understand why the laptops are out. I say that in, you know, I'm not anti-laptop, but, you know, my mentality is like, screens down, everybody in. And to a lot of my younger colleagues, screens down is not screen up is not mutually exclusive to everybody in, right? Like they feel like they need that screen up because they're taking notes or they're researching or they're doing all of those things. So help me understand is a pretty low cost question that also builds trust that you're not judging someone as wrong. In that article, we shared the example of younger people thinking their older colleagues on their team were not being responsive to them because they didn't respond to their texts after business hours, which is, again, like a simple example, was causing tension. Like, why aren't they responding to me? That's so rude. And so let's dig into it. Help me understand what's going on with the communication. And it turned out, you know, the older members of the team were saying, well, I don't really look at my phone once I get home and I'm with my family. I don't expect to be getting, ooh, I need to move more. My lights went out. I need to be, you know, really, you know, I'm not interested in, I don't text about work things or I don't deal with work related, you know, communications after a certain time. Whereas, you know, those were just not norms that a younger team members were subscribing to. So I think the practical thing here is, it's not your way or my way or right or wrong. It's let's learn what's going on. Help me understand what this is about. And then once I understand, then let's have a conversation about what our norm is going to be as a team or as an organization. And maybe it tends to sway more towards the one that you're comfortable with because that's more mission aligned for what we're doing. And through a discussion, I can understand why your sort of approach or norm makes sense. Or maybe it's more swayed towards mine, or maybe it's some combination of them. But, you know, it's very well supported that a conversation about why we're doing it a certain way or why we wouldn't want to do it a certain way helps get that buy-in and acceptance we need for trust and respect, as opposed to, well, we have to do it this way because we've always done it this way, or we have to do it a completely new way because it's 2022 and things, it's the new normal and things are never going to be like that again. Neither of those are true, right? So can we have a conversation to figure out what's going to work best for us, not cling to one set of norms versus the others?
Yeah. And I got to put up, this is kind of a funny story from Tara.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Tara. And you're right. You don't approach a moose. They can be pretty mean. So thanks for lightening it up. So Megan, I had two things. We got about 5 minutes to go. And I had two things I wanted to cover with you, two little topics real quick. Before we went on, I said, you know, I think what I think is unwritten these days, and again, I think it could be generational, but I think it's more of a boss, you know, employee dynamic is, you know, when you're these days, the employees are in the driver's seat. There's a lot of things that they want the employer to do for their benefit. What the employer, I think, is not saying, and this is where things get sideways, is you have to produce more value than you cost. You have to make my job easier. And you have to keep in mind that we are renting certain behaviors that we expect of you. And I don't think employers tell people that, but they have that expectation. And nobody knows that that's an expectation that, you know, how do I calculate that I am providing more value than I cost? How do I know I'm making your job easier, boss? Because in my mind, I might be thinking you're a servant, you know, to me, you're a servant leader. And then the other part is, what do you mean you're renting my behaviors? What do you mean I can't be defensive? I have to be accommodating to coaching and feedback and different things and get along and not say everything that I think necessarily. I mean, do you think that we should be a lot more upfront about those sorts of expectations with people?
I think we're in an era where we're redefining expectations. So I'm going to go back to my earlier answer. I mean, I think you're right that we get wires crossed because it goes back to the idea of, you know, we have in our workplaces now different eras of a mentality. Just if we take it back to even child rearing, right, which I'll get there in a second, but the idea that, you know, half of the generations in our workplace were raised in a time when the idea is children should be seen and not heard. So fast forward, and it's like the younger you know, younger, when you're low on the totem pole, quote unquote, you're a new person here, you sit down and pay attention and add value and help me, right? You're here to help me. And then we have two generations, I would say, that were raised when that was, we did a 180. It was almost a social experiment and said, what would be possible if we invested resources and time and energy into children at a very young age, right? Protected their self-esteem, gave them all a trophy. You've heard all of those sort of tropes. Yeah. And gave them, you know, language and art and travel and all of these experiences and heard who they were and what they wanted and developed them as a person way beyond the time when any of us thought we had the option to be developed as a person, right? And so in a way, we have these two different ideas about the value or the needs of employees and how prevalent they are. And so I'm going to go back to the fact that it's almost a, you know, it needs to be a little bit of a conversation around what kind of culture do we want to have, right? The idea, it's probably somewhere in the middle. And what happened when millennials first got to the workplace was they were, you know, leaving, not in actually any higher percentages than Gen Xers. That, again, was a stereotype. Gen X and millennials at the same age group left jobs at the same level, but millennials were much more vocal. I don't feel I'm valued here. I don't feel like anyone's interested in developing me. No one's listening to me. I'm leaving. That's where that entitlement came from. So then, you know, we now have a situation where, you know, I think we need to figure out what does it mean to coach and develop? And if the norm needs to be, look, you know, you need to help make my job easier. You need, you know, as a leader, my younger employees are here to add value and make my work easier. Having that conversation about why that is and why it matters. So I think the missing link there is unspoken assumptions don't work for Gen Z or millennials. They grew up getting to ask the questions, getting the explanations, having the conversations, and they're not going to accept that it just is that way because I say it's that way. That doesn't mean they're not going to be willing to, I mean, I've never found millennials or Gen Zs to not be interested in adding value, but they want to know why. What does that mean? Why do we do it that way? And how do we have a conversation where we're talking about why we have the norms we have? And some of them probably need to go, to be totally honest with you, but some of them are there for a reason. And so let's just have a conversation about why we do things a certain way, what my expectations are for you, what your expectations are for me, and how we're going to work together and not view it as, you know, it has to be this way because it always has been, or we have to throw out everything and completely recreate it. It's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. And Megan, what I'm taking away from you, which is really valuable, is, you know, again, wherever you're at, whether you're an employee or you're a boss, is to really pay attention to where somebody else is coming from, to ask a lot of questions so that you're not making assumptions. And there's probably a certain amount of compromise that's needed because, again, the only reason you hire employees is you can't get the work done all by yourself. You have to work through other people to get it done, to get the greatest production and high morale and real commitment from those people. Is going to take a little bit of explaining and helping people understand purpose and meaning and those kind of things. And kind of to wrap up today, you know, you talked about common needs. You hit on two of them already, respect and autonomy. The other two, before we go, you talked about connection and competence. So those I don't think we covered too much, but if I just wonder as we wrap up, if it goes really back to this, I mean, what we're talking about is humans connecting is really what we're talking about.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the, maybe again, takeaways and practical tools people can leave here today and start this conversation, whether it's at their dinner table or with people on their team, is what do those things mean to people in different career stages, ages, right? When we say connection, what does that mean to somebody, you know, that's working next to you? What does it mean to them to connect? Or what does it mean to them to feel like they're competent and not assuming it means the same thing to me? So again, these aren't, you know, these are just things we know through really strong leadership best practices, of course, make sense. For some reason, we've never applied this age and generational lens to it to say, well, wow, what an interesting, you know, difference this makes to think about how people might define these differently based on the time in which they started their career or, you know, the opportunities that they had in front of them in terms of work-family balance or job market or any of those different things. And so, you know, we're just adding these into the conversation, and it is, it's all about, you know, understanding how you can learn. And it's not just, you know, oh, geez, I have to slow down and explain myself to these younger people. They also have a lot of value to bring to the table. You know, there's so much to learn, whether it's from somebody older or younger, and we're just leaving that potential on the table, mm-hmm. right? And if we can use good leadership practices and apply them to these kinds of differences and then benefit from learning these different kinds of expertise or tapping into these different information networks, we're going to need to do that in order to be ready for whatever's next, since none of us really knows what that is.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I mean, there's so much, and I know you know, this isn't about a sales pitch or anything, but for those that are interested, you know, you've got the book, but you also have an academy that you've got some online. I mean, can you just mention that?
Sure. So it's gentelligenceacademy.com, and it's a remote learning platform. You can, it's self-paced, allows you to go through, it's all my training videos. It's a digital toolkit with exercises and all different things to do with your team. And then you become Gentelligence certified. At the end, you can also sign up to receive all kinds of updates from me at profgerhart.com. And would love to stay in contact. If people were interested enough to tune into us today, I would love to be able to stay in contact with them, hear about how these challenges are coming up in their world. That's my favorite thing. I speak all over the world, and I always hear something new and learn something about how these challenges are appearing in different industries. So would love to hear from everybody in the audience today.
All right. Well, great. Well, Megan, thanks for coming on. And this is really important these days. And, you know, I often say to people, you know, in meetings, and I take this from my podcast co-host, that you have somebody in the meeting keeping track of assumptions and keeping track of promises. The way I got connected with you is you talked about assumption audits and to really pay attention to that. And to me, that's one of the key things. And again, even as a coach, I mean, one of the things that happens as we develop competence is we spot patterns and trends, and we can decide, and it will serve us really well until it doesn't. You know, those patterns and trend recognition manifest themselves as biases and prejudices. And, you know, we it doesn't matter what age we are. We've got to constantly check those. And like Tom Rath, who wrote StrengthFinder, said, you know, StrengthFinder wasn't about you finding your strengths. It was really about you paying attention and finding strengths in other people. And I think that's a lot of what you're saying is, you know, look for the good.
Yeah, absolutely. Such an opportunity. And obviously we want to neutralize our frustration, but wouldn't it be great if we could go beyond that and think, well, what an asset to be working with people who, you know and understand things differently than I do because of when they grew up and when they started their career. What a gift.
Yep. Well, again, I want to say to everybody that was on, thanks for tuning in. We've gotten some really nice feedback from Mary and Brenda and Paul. So thank you. And Megan, thank you for all the work that you do.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And thanks to everyone for tuning in today. I appreciate you giving us your time.
All right. We'll see you all later. Bye-bye.